Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to take a visit out to the flight line and meet with two airmen who fly and fight in one of America's most sophisticated aircraft, the B-2. You've all seen pictures of the aircraft. It's absolutely incredible. A black flying wing that looks more like a spaceship than an aircraft. And these impressive optics are backed up by incredible capabilities. The aircraft can carry upwards of 80 precision-guided bombs on a single mission. It can fly thousands of miles around the globe before it requires refueling support. And most importantly, its stealth technology allows it to penetrate some of the most defended airspace on the planet, strike its assigned targets, and get home safely. They're also part of the nuclear triad, providing strategic deterrence in times of peace and critical options should circumstances ever require. The nation has only 20 B-2s in its inventory, so they are always in demand by the combatant commanders around the world. This demand is an interesting contrast to what leaders predicted at the end of the Cold War. The B-2 was originally designed to penetrate the air defenses of the Soviet Union and strike targets deep within the adversary nation. The requirement for stealth was driven by necessity. During the final days of the Vietnam War, the U.S. lost 15 B-52s in 12 days. That was against a set of defenses far less challenging than what airmen would have encountered in Eastern Europe. Results in the following conflict showed something had to change to better protect attacking air assets. Stealth was the response, with the F-117 and the B-2 as the corresponding aircraft to answer this need. The Cold War concluded right at the time the B-2 was transitioning into full rate production. Defense leaders determined that the requirement for the aircraft had eroded substantially and cut the buy from 132 aircraft down to just 21. We lost the B-2 in a crash several years ago, so the inventory now sits at just 20. Now, here's the thing. The exact opposite thing happened than was anticipated. The B-2 flew its first combat missions over Kosovo, and it never stopped engaging in combat. It has played an instrumental role in nearly every conflict since then. If an adversary gets out of line, the B-2 is inevitably deployed to deter the aggression, signal U.S. resolve, and reassure allies. Anyone can see this by simply reading the headlines, and it works. This gives leaders options they can exercise with tangible results felt in hours, not the days or months it would take surface forces to deploy, and that is the big deal. The Air Force knows that it needs more stealth bomber capacity, and that's why it started the B-21 program. These aircraft are currently in initial production, and we will see a first flight somewhere in the near future. I'd expect operational units to start getting these aircraft in the latter half of the 2020s. And airmen know America needs this bomber capacity as soon as possible. All right, so enough with the background. Today, I am pleased to introduce Lieutenant Colonel Chris Conant. His call sign is Crank, and he's the commander of the 393rd Bomb Squadron.
Thanks, excited to be here.
Awesome. And we have his boss, Colonel Keith Butler, the commander of the 509th Operations Group, who goes by Ghost.
So, Lick, I got to tell you, man, I am super excited to be on the podcast and get to work with you again from all of our time from, gosh, almost 20 years ago at Aviano to what we're doing now. Super excited to be here. Thanks.
Well, likewise. And I'm going to take a quick break here to say, you know, obviously, it's great to see you and talk to you, Ghost. And I can't believe it. It has been 20 years since you and I were brand new wingmen together in the greatest fighter squadron, the triple nickel, flying the F-16. And now here I am getting an opportunity to introduce you as the 509th Operations Group Commander and commanding just an incredible platform, the B-2.
Yeah, it's an amazing. If you had asked me back then over a conversation in the bar back then, or when we were flying over in Iraq about what our lives would be like in 20 years from now, I can promise you that being the 509th Operation Group Commander was nowhere in that decision matrix. But what a wonderful journey it's been, and the opportunities the Air Force has given me, my wife, and our family. And the same thing to you with being a weapons school instructor, a Thunderbird pilot, and now working for the AFA Mitchell Institute. Hats off to you, brother.
Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. And to get this thing rolling, Crank, thanks for being here as well. And, you know, one of the things I want to say that, you know, obviously we talked about how amazing the B-2 is, but you guys are the ones that trap into the jet and fly in harm's way. And you also lead the squadrons in the group to achieve mission success. So with that, I just want to say thanks and let's get this thing rolling. Obviously, I want to hear the first time it was like for you to fly the jet? I mean, this is one of the most incredible combat aircraft that's ever been designed. So what does it handle like?
Yeah. So, hey, first question is, you know, hey, man, I've been in the Air Force for almost 30 years now. And just like you, Slick, I'm a prior enlisted guy. We've had some amazing opportunities to do great work for our country. I started off in the F-16 with you there in the triple nickel at Aviano. Took a couple of years to fly with the F-117 over in Holloman. Great aircraft. And then when the Air Force decided to retire that program, I applied for it and got accepted into the B-2 program itself. And since then, the B-2 has pretty much been my home base, if you will. So that first flight for me was back in 2008. It was actually shortly after the crash on Guam as we were getting ready to return home from a bomber task force, or back then they were called continuous bomber presence deployments. And I got to be honest with you, I was really surprised coming out of fighters into a large, heavy bomber about its handling qualities and characteristics, and frankly, how responsive the aircraft was for being its big size. It was really a pleasure to fly. And I remember distinctly on that first sortie, we flew both conventional and nuclear mission sets in a training environment. We got up to go to the tanker. Big difference in flying a big airplane behind a 135 than an F-16 or a 117, I'll tell you. And then we came back home to beat up the pattern and kind of get an idea about what is it like to take off and land in a flying wing and the characteristics from it, just aerodynamics alone. The ground effect that you get, there's no vertical tail, how the wind really doesn't push you around. But at the same time, we never do the wing load method when it comes in for landing on a crosswind. Those wingtips are so far out from that main landing gear that if you move the aircraft more than 2 or 3 degrees in bank, you're going to scrape the wingtip out there. And so what we'll do is come in on a crab, and when the time is right, we'll just put a boot full of rudder in to line up with the runway. And since there's no vertical tail, the wind doesn't really push you around. You get to land straight on the center line of the runway. It's a very unique experience that other aircraft just, I've never seen it before in my life. But like everything else, once you get used to it, it's riding a bike.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, you talked about your career path, but I want to talk about what happens. Do folks come out of flight school and go right into the B-2 as their first operational assignment, or do they start with like the B-1 or B-52? I mean, obviously you have a unique career path with the F-16 and then the 117. So, well, what's it like today?
Yeah, so it's been a pretty unique ride. One of the great things that we pride ourselves in here at Whiteman in the B-2 program is it really is a melting pot of other communities. And that what's really one of the things that makes us a strong, very effective force for our country. From the first time the aircraft got here in 1993 until about 2000, about 10 years later, everybody we hired had to go through an interview process and it was selectively manned aircraft. You had to be experienced in other aircraft first. You had to have lots of hours. They wanted to make sure that you were the right kind of person to fly, frankly, the $2 billion aircraft. And then after a while, we realized, okay, we need to kind of open the aperture here a little bit. So about the time 2003 rolled around, we took a first couple of test cases, if you will, and we hired a few folks directly out of pilot training. Now, we also have the T-38 here as a companion trainer program because we don't fly the B-2 very often. Our line guys only fly the aircraft 2, maybe 3 times a month. That's it. It's an expensive aircraft to fly. So we use that T-38 to kind of fill in the gaps on flying hours and airmanship skills, situational awareness, and all the things that it takes to be a great pilot. Now, when those guys came over, that's exactly what they did. They flew the T-38 for a couple of years to get seasoned before we let them strap that $2 billion aircraft on their back and take it off into the sky. Since that was a successful experiment, we opened it up to some of our first assignment instructor pilot folks, those who graduate UPT or pilot training, and will stay behind for a couple of years to train new pilots coming into the Air Force. They got a lot of experience and a lot of hours in dynamic environments with young student pilots, and then we brought them in here. Now, today, what we do, we no longer do interviews. It is still selectively manned, but we don't go through the competitive process, if you will, that we used to. And so we're a little bit more expansive. So what we have now is about 16 pilots who come in a year, and we break that up into thirds. Third of direct hire, people right out of pilot training. About a third of them are those FAPES, first assignment instructor pilots. And about a third of them come from other weapon systems, B-52s and B-1s. We don't really hire into the F-16 or any of the other fighter communities anymore due to the nature of what we're dealing with from a pilot crisis issues and mannings that you have talked about in previous podcasts. So we kind of stay within more of the heavy community. But once in a while, once in a while, you might see a fighter guy show back up here. And again, that is a testament to those different experiences, what they bring, and makes us a better community.
Yeah, I mean, you've really grown the community from 1993 till now. And during that time period, it obviously covers a broad swath of time. So when you meet up with previous generations of B2 pilots, how does your experience contrast with theirs? And, you know, how is the mission and operational considerations and details surrounding the jet? How's that all evolved?
No, good question, man. It's a lot different. I'll be honest with you. The folks who come through now, and this is not to throw any spears at the folks who used to stay in the program up because they were incredibly qualified, but it was a different mission set back then. We were trying to explore the space of what this aircraft could do. And we could not do that with young pilots. We had to have the experienced folks that were there. Well, we're not there anymore. We pretty much know where all the corner cases are at on this aircraft, what it's capable of doing. And the folks that we bring into the program now are just so different. They can absorb new information so much faster. They have the ability to think tangentially about the mission sets that we do and how those have grown and evolved over the years, work with whether joint forces, partners, and allies, things that we didn't do in the past. It's just fantastic. It really is. Now, we don't go anywhere alone and afraid, man. You know that. We rely on fifth generation assets, platforms, and other support assets to how we maximize our ability to stay survivable and be operationally effective. So like, here's the bottom line, man. Our missions are more complicated now than they have ever been in the past. The jets are older than they have ever been in the past. And our crews are younger than they've ever been in the past. We rely on those folks and their ability to get the job done to make sure that our country stays safe.
Well, that rolls right into the next question I have for you. And it's discussing the mission, because you guys are busy. And you mentioned the Bomber Task Force deployments that you've been executing. And it's probably the most visible to the nation and to our allies and obviously to our adversaries of the B-2's role around the world in recent months. So what's the macro objective on how you guys make it happen?
Great question, man. And I'll tell you, for this one, I'm going to turn the markers, hand them over to Crank. I think he's much better suited than I am to answer this question.
Thanks, awesome. Boss. The way I like to think about it is these bomber task forces or BTFs, it's our national defense strategy in action, first and foremost. The name is what it is. It sounds just like it says, right? So it's a force that comes together to perform a task. And that macro objective is in the national defense strategy, and we're changing it up, right? So the adversary is evolving, we're evolving faster. So the buzz line there is that the whole objective is to be operationally unpredictable. And what that means is at the operational level of war, so think AORs or combatant commands, you know, CENTCOM, UCOM, PAYCOM, at that level, you know, bombers are gonna pop up in places we haven't been before. We're going to go places and fly with allies we haven't flown with before. And we're going to press a test on some new ideas and some new evolutions in everything we do, from mission planning to where we fuel up the jets, called a hot pit, which is what we did on one of our last ones, to how we communicate with our allies and other players. So the whole thing's wrapped up. It's really cool and really new. They're also much shorter in duration. So again, we kind of pop up in a new place. We're there for a little while. We fly some missions for the combatant commanders, and then we go home and we float another mission set that we've got here at Whiteman Air Force Base. And it's not just the B-2s, right? So if you follow the news and follow Global Strike Command assets for, you know, the last year, really, and even during a pandemic, we've got bombers everywhere. You see, you know, B-2s were just out at lodges. I took the squadron out to Diego Garcia back in August. We've got B-1s in Norway, we've got B-52s flying all over the place as well. So it's just at the kind of the headquarters level, bombers are going everywhere, being unpredictable all over the place around the world. And that's kind of what we're trying to do to achieve those national objectives for the country.
Well, you touched on it. So how are the allies responding to these deployments and on these missions as you get to fly with them? And what do you think from our adversaries' perspective? Is there any way to sense their take on the presence?
I mean, I hope so. I can't speak to, you know, the government level responses too much, but at the tactical level, when I'm there on the ground, you know, in the trenches, so to speak, with our allies and partners, it's awesome. So the coolest part I found is, I like to say that, you know, we're all speaking the same language and trying to do the same thing, but we use different words in a sense, right? So just going through that process and understanding how each other talks, how we plan, how we integrate, how we think about warfighting, all come to find out we pretty much think the same way and want to solve the same problems. And then we figure it out and go forth and conquer, you know, and get the integration piece. That's really been the most rewarding part, I think, for me and for all my crew dogs, as we say in the show, in the business here, as we integrate with, we were with the British and with the Navy out in Diego, and then with our Portuguese allies and the NATO mission at Lodge's air base recently. So I think it's all goodness. We're doing a lot of new things too. So we're evolving the fifth gen piece. So like Ghost said, you know, we never go anywhere alone, right? We're always going to integrate with both joint, so other military branches, and coalition, other countries' militaries. And so we're doing new integration missions with F-35s all around NATO. So United Kingdom, we just integrated with Norwegian F-35s, and that's all new. So again, working that out and figuring out how we talk and work and fight war together. I mean, we know, if without a fact, right, that war fighting is a team sport. I mean, that's something that history has proven over and over again. So that's what these are really all about. As far as the adversaries go, I mean, we know they know we're there, right? That's the whole point. And we have other ways of figuring out kind of and assessing what their responses are to us. And then it's kind of a multinational approach too. So we've got some feedback from all of the non-military branches of government, right? So the whole point is to be the stick, you know, to back up the diplomats. And so there have been some data points coming back to say from, you know, State Department and other places, like, look, you know, we've got bomber task forces here doing this thing, and that's helping support that other branch of government, which I think is just really powerful, right? And really cool. So that's kind of how I see the allies and adversaries piece to these deployments.
Well, you know, in your discussions causing me to think back, and Ghosh, you mentioned losing a B-2 in 2008. And just from my personal experience, I was part of a theater security package that went to Guam for quite a long time in 2007. And we're compadres with B-52s and B-2s in the area during that time. So can you compare what you're doing now with Bomber Task Force compared to the older style missions that were executed in the Pacific with this, you know, I guess the former continuous bomber presence that like was on Guam?
You bet. In some ways, they're very similar, and in other ways, they're very different, brother. And here's what I mean by that. When we were doing continuous bomber presences, deployments, if you will, we were doing those in a way to have that enduring jets on the ground deterrence factor for combatant commanders for a long period of time, anywhere from 4 to 6 months, frankly. And that was in Indo-PACOM, back then it was PACOM, and CENTCOM, and then other places as well. Sometimes you would actually conduct contingency operations. A lot of times it was just being present. And that sends a message to our potential and understood adversaries that we have with us around the world. It sends a big message when our country is willing to send our strategic bomber fleet out there and park it on the ground with the range that they've got and what the capabilities are they can bring to the fight. And over time, we started to wear those aircraft down at a faster rate than they were designed for, particularly in the B-1, from what they were doing in CENTCOM, flying every day over and over again. We had to take a new look at what that meant for the long-range health of our bomber fleet. And so some decisions were made at high levels about how do we still achieve the effect of that continuous bomber presence, but do it in a way that Crank alluded to, for having that operational surprise, if you will, or dynamic force employment of you don't know where we're going and when we're showing up and when we're coming home. And that's just the way we want it, because we want to keep folks on their toes. That's the biggest difference, frankly, between that CBP construct and what we're doing now with BTS. I would argue from a B-2's perspective, when we would go on the CBP, we didn't integrate a whole lot. We would do some things with the Navy once in a while. We've taken, opened up the aperture with that, with partners and allies, as Crank alluded to, with Norwegian F-35s and integration with other countries, and giving them an opportunity to fly near the aircraft, to do tours with the aircraft and get to know them so that they understand some of our capabilities and what we bring to the fight, so that the next time we meet, which may be in the AOR, we've got a familiarity with our operations and how we do business.
Well, it's incredible. I'm just taking in what you're saying and thinking about how much you guys have on your shoulders with just 20 aircraft. And that's just during peacetime, right? So the wartime demand is obviously going to be more demand and more stress. Can you talk about some of the challenges, you know, especially as a group and a squadron commander that you have from both an aircraft and a personnel perspective?
It is very interesting because we, on a lot of our global strike missions that we fly in combat, we've done this before. We may get the chance to do it again. We'll see. But we will take off from Knob Noster, Missouri, literally the middle of the country. And we will fly in either direction, cross an ocean, go take care of business, and fly all the way back home. And those combat missions will reside anywhere from approximately 30 hours in the air nonstop up to our world record combat mission of 44 hours in the air nonstop. And if you don't mind, I'd like to bring Crank back up here because he's one of the few folks that in recent memory has had the chance to actually fly in combat. And I'd like to share his story. Crank, over to you.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, sure. It was a pretty rewarding experience, as you can expect. Emerging target set of some ISIS camps in Libya back in 2017. And the B-2 provides some unique capabilities. So fundamentally, we're pretty quiet, obviously. We can be seen or unseen, depending on how we want to flow into the AOR. In that case, we decided to be a little bit louder and, you know, not be as quiet as we can be. And fundamentally, I could bring a Mark II ship 160 500-pound JDAMs. And so for the audience, that's a lot of bombs. And I can pattern manage and basically create shapes in my jet of what you want that target to look like. So the whole construct was, we have these camps, we don't know where these guys are, they might be moving. And so kind of the unique part of that mission in historical context to everything else in the B-2 is we took off and didn't know what we were going to strike. We had a pretty rough idea, like, you know, a general location and some pre-planned target sets. So again, took off out of the middle of the country, did the first air refueling just off New England, 100,000 pound gas offload, flew across the Atlantic, did another air refueling through the straits there. And then we got in contact with our customer, and he dropped a whole bunch of targets on the two ship. I can't remember the exact number. I want to say it was 25-ish or so targets between the two ship. And we had about an hour and a half till the time over target to get to Libya, and sorted it out between the two of us. We created the targets in the jet, which is a lot of button pushes, and we're ready to go. And it had a simultaneous dispersed impact points. I can't remember how far apart the camps were. I want to say about 10 miles or so in the middle of the night. We wanted to keep it quiet, you know, like wake those guys up, and did the job in one swoop, came off target. And we were actually cleared out to go home early because we were done. We had done basically all the damage. Orbited over the Mediterranean for a little bit. One of the kind of rewarding points of the story for me was that third tanker, which if I didn't get that gas, man, I was diverting my $2 billion bomber somewhere in Europe, which we obviously try to avoid, and showed up to the tanker. The autopilot was broken. All the lights were broken, and it was the middle of the night. And luckily, the moon was really bright that night. So I basically just refueled in kind of a shadow to figure out what I needed to do. Got the gas and reverse flow all the way back to Missouri. So another AR off the straits heading west now. And it was five air refuelings in total before we made it back home for about a 33-hour flight. So, you know, it's kind of a unique thing to do, but we also, it's not very unique. So I put all my pilots through that type of training. We do 24, 30-hour sorties a few times a year. And that's the standard that all B-2 pilots train to and strive to. We learn how to manage fatigue, manage our meals, manage some naps sometimes. And that's kind of a really unique piece that the bomber fleet brings to the fight. And with our jet, we don't augment our crews. There's no room. So it's just two pilots. That's all you got. We're ready to go. So that's kind of the elevator pitch story there.
No, I was going to say it's absolutely incredible. We could probably just do an entire podcast just talking about you know, the human factors that you deal with. But I will force myself to not be a pilot myself and want to ask you a bunch of questions. But I'll stay focused on what we're talking about here. And one of the next things I wanted to ask you about was modernization in the B-2. So what are you guys thinking about for modernization efforts, and what do you have underway to keep the B-2 relevant?
Oh, that's a good question. So without getting into specifics and without getting into things that we frankly just don't discuss in open channels, I will tell you that our current bomber fleet, and this is all of them, we use some pretty innovative ways to integrate modern weapon capabilities in order to have us both maintain and increase our survivability. And for the B-2 specifically, the expansion of some of our strike capabilities allow us to increase our survivability beyond the fighter escort realm. Now, the B-2's fleet is continuing to do that technological advancement, and that enables us to expand our strike capabilities as well. Although we've been around for over 30 years, there's a lot of life left in this platform. And up until the B-21 is well on the scene and doing its job, this aircraft will continue to be at the forefront of our country and our nation's defense.
All right. Well, then with that modernization, how does this play into the strategic deterrence value, you guys being the nation's sword and shield?
Good question. So what we're trying to work through is our nation's adversaries, and frankly, our friends as well, it's just a cool airplane. People always want to know more about this aircraft. We take this aircraft to air shows. We do flyovers, Super Bowl, for example, back in January, the Tri-Bomber flyby that we did. What an awesome event that was. Those are examples of how we showcase the timing of aircraft, the integration of our nation's strategic bomber fleet in a very public ways. Other ways we do it, as we described earlier, from that bomber task force deployment construct, those are all visible signs of what is our nation's most visible aspect of our triad between the ICBM fleet, the SLBM fleet, and the bomber fleet. We are the most visible, we're the most recallable, and it sends the biggest message from our nation's leaders, military and civilian, of when they want to send that strategic message. And every time that we go to war in the B-2, which, to be frank, isn't that often. It's only about once every 6 or 7 or 8 years. But when the B-2 gets released from our cage and we get to go across the country and across the planet to go take care of business, it is as much a strategic communication statement of our nation's will that we are willing to put the $2 billion aircraft into harm's way. And it does a pretty good job, frankly. We have never, ever failed. And with these and continued innovative upgrades and weapon system capabilities, we will continue to do that until the last jet flies off the ramp into retirement.
And it sounds like that's not going to happen for quite some time, I'm sure. But it does cause me to think about the B-21. And there's nobody more exciting to talk to about the B-21 than you guys. And I want to hear what you think about the scale of the B-21 buy, because I'm assuming we're going to need more than 21, which we did with the B-2. So what are your thoughts there for numbers?
No, it's good. Those numbers have fluctuated over the years for those who are students of Bomber Air Power, Strategic Air Power, the Global Strike Command Bomber Roadmap. And General Ray has been very clear on this, that those 100 aircraft that we need, that's the floor. That is the floor of that purchase, not the ceiling. This aircraft is going to replace the B-2 and it's going to replace the B-1. So as General Ray had mentioned in a previous podcast that was recently released to the public, we fully support those numbers. And while we may be partial to the B-2, because that's our home and it's where we are, we know that technology marches on, time marches on, and that new aircraft and new technologies come out. And the B-21 is frankly overdue. Our bomber fleet in our country is old, and it is, in some respects, pretty tired. That's not to say that we are ineffective, and that's not to say that we can't get the job done. We absolutely can. But if our country chooses to want to stay in the fight from a national and international security perspective and hold targets at risk anywhere on the planet at any time, we have to maintain that cutting or sometimes bleeding edge technology. That is what the B-21 will provide.
Now, that's awesome. And I like that, the bleeding edge technology, because you're right. I mean, it's a lot of hard work and sacrifice for folks. And one of the other things that I'm thinking about, because I know we've been talking about the conventional and kind of flirted with the conversation about the nuclear mission, but how do you balance the responsibility of both? And how does it impact your training and the way you manage your crews and the way you manage your aircraft?
Nuclear weapons are much different than conventional weapons. No surprise there. But when you are dealing with an aircraft that, to your point, has a dual doc statement in it, designated operational capability, we've got two different mission sets that we use. Conventional weapons use chemical explosives to create that explosive reaction. And it has an upper limit to that, whether that's a 500-pound bomb, a 2,000-pound bomb, or the ones that are even higher than that. When you talk about nuclear weapons, you are literally talking about the splitting and connection of atoms, atomic reactions. And that is where the energy and the destructive power of nuclear weapons come in. One of the things that we find amazing about what we do is that our nation trusts us with that power. We are the 509th Bomb Wing. Our heritage is the 509th Composite Group. This is the unit that dropped those two atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki back in August of 1945 to help end World War II in the Pacific. That is a tremendous heritage. Our squadron patch, I'm sorry, our wing patch is the only patch authorized in the entire Department of Defense to have a dual mushroom cloud on it, as a heritage, as a hearkening back to what that means for our folks. And we honor that every single day. The weight of responsibility that our air crew has when we ask them, heaven forbid, would we ever do it? But if we ask them to go into the heart of the adversary to employ nuclear weapons, we train every single day to do that. And we take it incredibly seriously. So like we go places that no one else can go. And we do things that no one else can do in order to keep our country safe, man. We are General Ray's warfighters. That's our job. Deterrence is the effect that we achieve by being combat ready.
Of course, we've talked a lot about the B-2, and it's just one of the three bomber types in the U.S. inventory right now. Can you talk to us about the B-1 and the B-52 and how they engage? What can they do, and what missions exceed their capacity?
So strategic bombers have a lot of things in common, and there are some things that are separate from each one of those. The B-52 is obviously, when you think Cold War, you can't help but think B-52. They just go hat in hand with each other. And that B-52 has a lot of life left in it. The Air Force has big plans for that aircraft. Re-engineering of engines, radar modernization, wheels and brakes coming in online, upgrades to computer systems, on and the list goes on and on and on. That aircraft is going to service our country for a long time to come in the future. The one thing it doesn't have, frankly, is stealth. Unfortunately, that's an old airplane, and you can see that thing rolling in from a long ways away. So they make up for it with things like standoff weapons and tactics and things like that. All good things. The B-1, it's a little bit more stealthy, if you will, than the B-52, but not to modern day standards. What the B-1 brings to the fight, what it was initially designed for, is that dual dock statement, which they don't do the nuclear mission anymore. But they were designed to go low and go fast. Four gigantic afterburning engines to get you somewhere really, really quick. The capabilities they bring on board with their sensors and their platforms, and frankly, both the B-52 and the B-1 have targeting pods now. And so from a close air support mission perspective, dynamic targeting of things, it's just a gigantic truck that brings a lot of weight to it, to the warfighters, whether that's somebody on the ground or whether that's somebody in the air that needs additional help. And they can do precision as well, because most everything we carry now, you can independently target it from a GPS-aided munition, or you can laser it in from that targeting pod, right? They've got the range. All bombers are long range. It's one of the things we pride ourselves in our country, frankly, and what separates us apart from the rest of the world. What makes the B-2 unique, though, is we've got five aspects that no other aircraft in the world has, and that is stealth, range, payload, precision, and penetration, both from the aircraft perspective as well as the weapons. Our penetrating weapons that we carry, both nuclear and conventional, the MOP, for example, the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, the GBU-57, that is a 30,000-pound conventional weapon designed to go after hard and deeply buried targets in some of the most heavily defended areas of the world. We carry two of them. And when you have multiple aircraft carrying those kinds of weapons, that's when we mean business. And we go in for real.
Now, how do you expect the long-range strike mission to evolve with the B-21? I mean, obviously the jet will be stealthy, but what sets the B-21 radar apart is it will have incredibly powerful sensors a tremendous level of processing power, and connectivity to team with the rest of the force. And this is a lot different than the early model of stealth, especially Ghost. I know you flew the F-117 when you literally had to go dark from the time you crossed into enemy territory. This is a greater reflection of the joint all-domain command and control type of construct. And can you talk us through that? Because the ability to put a sensor shooter behind enemy lines seems like a huge advantage.
I sure can, man. That's really a two-part answer to your question. I mean, the first part is about long-range strike, the B-21 piece of it. That's really the first part of the question, if I'm reading into what you're asking us. And I'll be honest, that B-21 piece, it only becomes more important with time about the importance of the role of long-range strike and what the Air Force's core mission is that we've been doing for decades. And frankly, we do it better than anybody else on the planet. That's not prideful, and it's not boasting if you can do it. And we've done it over and over and over again. And everybody in the world knows that. You've talked about it on your podcast before, man. Stealth is the coin of the realm. That is the ticket to the dance in today's fights against our most advanced adversaries and those who have a higher level threat system. The B-21, it gives our country additional capabilities. It gives us upgraded technology. It allows us to increase the mission sets from what we can even do in the B-2 today. If you think about it from the perspective of B-21, going to do everything from a permissive CAS environment all the way up to night one, integrated air defense system takedowns, and nuclear war. And while these two jets might look similar, the B-2 and the B-21, I would caution the listener to never judge a book by its cover. Similar to what you had heard on the F-35 podcast, a lot of the differences, frankly, are on the inside. Now, for the second part of that question, I'm going to let Crank answer that.
Sure. Thanks. The way I like to think about this is, communication really is what links everything together. So this is a lot more complicated than just a bomber dropping a bomb or a fighter shooting a missile, right? And kind of the rough parallel example we can talk to a little bit is the F-35 discussion. And I don't want to get into all the acquisition side of that, obviously, but from a warfighting capability, the power the F-35 brings to the fight is that sensor shooter piece. It's that connective node that it can sense everything going on in the battle space. It can communicate that out to other forces and makes the entire joint force or coalition force, right? Because Norwegians have it now and other players, that much more lethal. And so I see a same parallel with the B-21 piece. You talked briefly about the joint all domain command and control. And I don't want to get into I would love to get into a doctrinal discussion about that sometime. But for the listener, I mean, think of it like, if you're a football team, right? And you can't communicate or call plays, how effective are you? And that's what these sensor shooters are bringing to that fight. And it kind of ties back into what we mentioned earlier too, with the B-2. And this is a common misconception because we're quote unquote stealthy. So let's just send them in, launch the fleet. We'll get the job done. It's like, no, that's not quite how it works. We're never alone. We've never been alone. And I would argue we're never going to be alone from a multi-domain perspective. And by that, I mean, like, we're always going to need space because we have to talk across the globe. So we always need space communications. We're going to use cyber effects to help, us fight our way into enemy territory. And then we're obviously going to be with our, electronic attack brothers, our communication brothers, all those different capabilities together. And that's really, really what makes next generation stealth, whether it's a fighter or a bomber, really just, when you see it come together, it's eye watering. And I was actually in the weapons school, which is kind of the Air Force's version of Top Gun, but way cooler, back in 2015, and the F-35 was rolling in for the first time. And to see that thing do what it can do, in the real kind of fight, it changes your perspective than what you just kind of read on the news every day. So, I'm expecting the B-21 to be the same kind of evolution in terms of lethality. And I'm really, really excited for the crew force that gets to employ it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, combining a sensor shooter behind enemy lines with the stealth capability and the communication piece that you talked about is absolutely going to be incredible. I just want to throw this one out to you both in a couple sentences. If there was a key takeaway that you want our audience to remember from this podcast about the bomber mission, what would it be? So we'll go with Crank first.
Let's see. I mean, one thing I always harp on that we're really proud of, like Ghost mentioned, was our heritage. Talked about the end of World War II in the Pacific. Reminder too, for the 8th Air Force, which is still in effect today, is a numbered Air Force with all the bombers in it. The 8th Air Force effectively set the stage to win World War II in Europe, right? They actually lost more aircrew than the whole Marine Corps did in that war. So I'd want people to take away from, you know, the bomber community that it's kind of where our Air Force started, really. If you go back to the founders, they were looking at long range strike as kind of the key, and it changed the nature of warfare for mankind ever since that those two detonations in Japan. And so that's kind of why we think about ourselves as war fighters in that regard. I know the other thing too, a little bit, maybe sort of more tongue in cheek, but you know, if you want to fly something that can really do some damage, right? Come fly a bomber and we'll get you ready to go. And it's a pretty cool thing to witness. And it's pretty cool to be able to do it for our country. And again, the whole point really is that we're combat ready and we're war fighters to go do that mission so that hopefully we actually never have to go do it, especially in the nuclear realm. That's kind of the whole point, right? It's a little bit of a paradox in that regard, but it's a really powerful one to think through. So again, we take that very seriously and very, very excited about that, proud of that mission.
Awesome. All right, Ghost, how about you?
Yeah, brother, I'll tell you, I'm going to pile on to one thing that Crank had said there, and that's talking about the effect that bombers have on our nation's adversaries and when we go to conflict. And you've talked about this in previous podcasts. I'm not going to rehash those things, but some of the other guests that you have had on the show really highlighted the fact about where we are as a country and where we are as a military and how few platforms we actually have left. And the platforms that we do have, how old they are. We need to do a recapitalization of that. Now, having said that, we're wrapping up as we speak a strategic deterrence exercise here internally to the base. And all of these aircraft have their own docks in them, all surrounded, alarms, security forces, maintainers, and all the support folks that it takes to pull off this mission set. When we do this, and we do what's called a response to aircraft, and this is literally Cold War style mechanics of going out there to do our nation's worst mission on the worst day. And you watch those crews go out there, running to the cars, driving very fast over to the docks, racing, sometimes in their uniforms, sometimes in shorts and t-shirts because it's the middle of the night, racing up the ladder, cranking the engines up, if you will, ready to actually execute that mission set. That is something that we actually practice. And we do that to hone those skills so that, again, as I said earlier, heaven forbid we ever had to do it for real, we're ready to go. And the strategic nature and the benefit that strategic bombers bring to our nation's arsenal in support of the national defense strategy, there is nothing else out there, literally nothing else out there that provides the firepower, the flexibility, and the ability to penetrate into our enemy's worst IADs and air defense systems to get the job done. Nobody else can do that, period.
Oh, it's amazing. All right, last question. Each of you give me your favorite B-2 flying story.
Frank, you first.
Well, I talked to the combat story already. I think my answer would be at kind of the individual level. And so what I mean by that is just the day-to-day flying as a, you know, an instructor, getting that young pilot, making him CMR, combat mission ready, and then giving him the skills he needs to, you know, pull that off with, you know, he's over the ocean in the middle of the night, dodging thunderstorms, has to get the 100,000 pounds of gas offload to make it home. And so those daily reps we do, I get a lot of reward out of that, just seeing those guys grow. And so talk about the combat story a little bit, but other than that, that's kind of my answer, just seeing those young guys develop. It's really rewarding.
Well, I expect nothing less from a weapons officer than the pride of making one more and one more, you know, imparting your knowledge onto somebody else and seeing that reward. So that was awesome. How about you, Ghost?
So I have not had the opportunity to fly the B-2 in combat yet, but if it does happen, that will be my most favorite sortie. Short of that, there's been some really cool opportunities to showcase the B-2 to the public, and those are always fun sorties. And there's a little bit of selfish pride that comes with that about showcasing those jets. And that's a good thing. But I'll be honest with you, man. And it's not about me at this point. It's about making sure that we are combat ready. And what I get the most satisfaction out of, and Crank talked to this earlier, when we send a 2 or a 3 ship off on one of our long duration missions, and that's anything north of 24 hours in duration, and we send them off and it's cold, It's rainy. There's low clouds. You got to get to the tanker. You have to fight your way all the way through across whatever ocean we're going to go integrate with whoever we're going to integrate with, to go make sure our communication systems work and our targeting systems work, and that we are demonstrating that strategic deterrence. And then they come back home and they got to fight their way back through. And they've been up for 30 plus hours. And there's only two people. Nothing is augmented. One person flies, one person sleeps, right? Maybe. And you come back home and you come into low ceilings and low visibility, and you bring the jets back in and they hop out and there's nobody there. And what I mean by that is there's no welcome home party. There's no wives and spouses and families welcoming you back after that hard fought mission. You've got the crew chiefs out there. We've got the defenders out there and the support folks. They land the jet, they put more gas on it and put two more crew in, and then take back off again on the next mission. It's just part of who we are. So when people think about the perspective of, I'm going to go fly for an hour or 2 hours, or if I'm in combat, if I'm going to go to contingency, it might be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. When you fly an aircraft for literally an entire day and then some, and you come back and you land, and it's no big deal, and the next crew goes on and goes and flies it, that's when you know you're combat ready, because it's something that we do every day. That's what I take away from this mission set.
Well, Ghost, I have to tell you, on a personal front, I'm really, really glad that you were able to illustrate for our listeners what goes on within your group and at your wing, down to the squadron level, to the defenders and the crew chiefs, because this is a humility that the Air Force runs with quite often. And like you said, there's nobody waving a banner after that long mission and you come home. And I think General Goldfein, when he was the chief of staff, he mentioned, you know, the Air Force in many ways is like electricity. You just expect it to work. You flip a light switch on in the room and you expect the light to come on, just like we selfishly take our crews that are standing at the ready to do the nation's worst war on the worst day, as you said it. And I really appreciate you bringing that to context for us. So thank you so much.
You bet, brother.
All right. Well, hey, gentlemen, thank you both so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. It's been an incredible conversation with you both, and I look forward to chatting with you again.
Thanks again so much, Slick. Talk to you soon.
Slick, can't thank you enough again. Hopefully folks got something out of this and love talking about the B-2 like any other pilot loves talking about their aircraft. So thank you for the opportunity to be part of the AFA, the Mitchell Institute, and the Aerospace Advantage. Love what you guys are doing. Keep doing it.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.